We communicated by email, and you were unsure about whether you'd be available for May or not. Is that resolved yet?
What's the date?
Sorry. It's the third Wednesday, whatever that is.
I'm on vacation on the 21st, but I believe the Wednesday is the 20th.
I think it's
17th.
No, the 9th is a Tuesday, so the 10th is a Wednesday, so it's the 17th.
Oh, okay, yeah, then that's fine. Yeah.
I have an algorithm for figuring that out. I give you the day for any date.
9 to 5 at the 7-Eleven?
That's it. You know that one.
Yeah.
Did we talk about it?
Yes, I told you. I was the one who told you.
Yes. No, I learned about it before I moved to Mexico.
Really?
Yeah.
Just a suggestion, as long as it's being recorded. You know, I was looking at it, and you know, and if we don't do anything, then you don't know who's talking. So I thought we should introduce ourselves.
We should what?
Introduce ourselves.
Okay, we'll do that. Yeah, I just wanted to find out what's going on with Philip.
Called the Chapala Diet.
Do you know whether you're going to be available for May?
Yes,
I will be. Okay, good. So we'll book you for May, whatever your topic is. You told me about it.
How about
it was free will.
You asked me,
free will. That's right. Good. Thank you. And we'll talk about it.
We settled that last year.
All right. At John's recommendation, let's go around and introduce ourselves since we have two new people and just say a word or two. Henry?
Word or two, Henry.
Okay. That's his word.
That's it.
Chad?
Chad Olson.
That's two words.
Vice Chairman.
Uh-huh.
Past President, past Chair.
Ex-Chair. Ex-Mormon and Ex-Chair.
Okay. Michael?
Michael Rose, English, ex-Jew.
Ex-Jew? You're never an ex-Jew. You could drop out of Christianity, but I don't think you can drop out of Judaism.
Take it a few minutes.
Phil Rylance, no, ex-ex, I don't know, just lump it all together. Right? Couple of
Jerry, non-theist since Bible school.
Okay. John Duval, a non-theist ever since I was born.
Rod Napier, ex-vice chair.
There's a lot of vice in this neighborhood, by the way.
We have a lot of vice,
non-theist since you were conceived.
Sorry?
Non-theist since you were conceived, since you were
Josh. Is that all you want to say? Okay, good.
I'm Roseanne Wagner.
Hey, Roseanne, and you've lived here 20 years, I heard?
Yeah, in September it'll be 20 years.
Okay, well, welcome, and
Thank you.
Found us, and I hope you have a good time today.
Thank you.
You staying?
Hey, Brad.
I'm staying.
Well, you're just in time to introduce yourself, Brad. Go ahead.
I am Fred Harland.
Anything else you want to say?
Great thinker.
I've been down here for part-time 10 years, full-time 10 years. Strong atheist, Unitarian, interested in science.
Okay, that's a nice capsule summary. Lucretia?
I'm Lucretia Thomas. I've been here for 17 years. I think I am 100% agnostic.
100% agnostic, okay. Maybe we can talk about that for a minute. How about you, Gene?
Gene Crone. I've been here for 5 years, and I'm 100% atheist.
So do you consider that different from agnostic?
Yes.
Okay, do you consider atheist and agnostic different?
Yes.
Okay. You know, there's another way people are speaking today. They're not different kind of people. They're just calling themselves by different words.
Yeah.
And so I'm a person who says that I don't believe in God, but I'm not going to go so far as to say that gods are impossible and can't exist. Any more than I would say the leprechauns are impossible and can't exist. You know, I just have no reason to believe in either, so I'm an atheist. But because I will not say that gods do not exist, I also call myself an agnostic. So, agnosticate this. In that formulation, there's room for both.
But if I were speaking to somebody who didn't declare themselves an atheist, I'd be inclined to say, well, can you explain to me why there are 100,000 gods you don't believe in? And once you do that, then I'll explain to you why I don't believe in Jehovah.
Well, we just believe in one less god than one believe.
I've heard that one before.
Well, you know, if someone's trying to proselytize to you and they're trying to push, say, the Christian Bible, can you ask them why they don't accept the Quran? You know, whatever their reason is, that's my reason. You know, there's nothing more to say than that. There's no reason for me to believe that. That's kind of what we say. Hello, welcome. You're welcome. Come on and have a seat, please. Ladies, so you can sit on either end of the table. We've just been introducing ourselves, so your timing is perfect.
Okay.
You didn't introduce yourself.
You missed who we are, huh?
You didn't introduce yourself.
Okay, I'll do that last. Can you tell us your names and a little bit about yourself, if you don't mind? I know you just walked in the door.
Oh, sorry. Jude
Jude? And I'm from Canada, Calgary, Alberta.
Okay, good.
And I'm coming today because I'm kind of curious to see what this group's about.
Okay, good. And you, please?
Similar. My name is Jeanette Livingston. I'm from, most recently from Washington, D.C. And I just love going to different groups to see what they discuss.
You're welcome.
And how people think and try to keep an open mind about things.
Okay, so thank you. And anybody who's new to this group, if you like what you saw and you want to be on the email list, let Henry know, okay?
Okay,
and I'm Stephen, and I'm the chair this year. It's kind of not, it's not something I was looking for, but you found me.
You were drafted.
I was drafted. I was conscripted into this. What we do here is we meet once a month and we talk about assorted subjects. We call ourselves freethinkers, which I tend to think of as a euphemism for atheist. The word atheist has been tarnished. It's a dirty word for a lot of people. And as soon as you say atheist, it becomes Satan. So a lot of people just don't want to use that word. So they use other words. They go, I'm an agnostic, or I'm no religious, irreligious, or I'm an unbeliever, or I'm a freethinker, or I'm whatever, skeptic. There's all kinds of... But to me, anybody that doesn't believe in a God is an atheist. That's what the word means to me. Although a lot of people have a different definition of atheist. They say you have to actually go so far as to, and say there are no gods. Like I said, I won't say that. How could I know that? I could say it, but I'd be taking a leap of faith that I can't justify. Okay. What we're going to be doing today is completing a two-part discussion on evolution. The first part was about evolution in general. This is going to be focused more on human evolution. But we're going to be doing two completely different kinds of things that I think are pretty unrelated. But they come together here. First, we're going to be talking about the evolution of man, which is basically science, biology. And then I want to start talking about the common arguments against evolution, which are all religious. There really isn't a good argument against evolution. Yeah, so just start by saying that. But then we'll just talk about the different kinds of things that people will say to object to this theory, people trying to defend their faith from what they consider to be scientific incursion into it. So I said last month what we did, I gave you a definition for evolution, and we talked about the different kinds of evidence in support of it. Such as, for example, the nested hierarchies, the predictive power of the theory, the radiocarbon dating, the strata of fossils and how they're arranged exactly like evolution predicts they would be. If you go deep enough, you should find only simpler forms. You shouldn't find a human being in strata that are 200 million years old. I mean, if you do, something's wrong. Alright, now what we're gonna do is, like I said, we're gonna focus mostly on primate evolution, going from, lesser apes to what we are today, but I want to just race right through evolution, starting with the first cell. And like all life on Earth, man is thought to have descended, according to the mechanism proposed by Charles Darwin, from a common ancestor that lived billions of years ago. Life was on Earth by 3.8 billion years ago, when the Earth was about 750 million years old. We don't know how many times life formed on Earth. It may not have formed on Earth. There's a theory called, or a hypothesis called panspermia, where it formed elsewhere and was delivered to Earth on the backs of the rocks. But if life evolved here on Earth, which it may well have, it may have had to do that over and over, because the Earth was being bombarded by asteroids in a period, an eon called the Hadean Eon, where there was a, just like I said, constant bombardment of the Earth, and anything that started to live would probably have been killed. But eventually it has slowed down, and there were places for life to hide. You know, there was a big hit that destroyed the dinosaurs, but there were a lot of burrowing creatures that survived it. So eventually some of these animals find safe haven. Okay, so after about 750 million years, however many times life formed on Earth, it was pretty much here for good now. It was the simplest possible cell or biological replicator. That's where evolution begins. Once we have something that's alive, when you get into these conversations with the believers, they frequently confuse the period of chemical evolution when we went from simple molecules like methane and water to living cells. That period is called chemical evolution. It's not about Darwin's theory. Darwin's theory doesn't begin until the first thing that can reproduce and send its genetic material to its descendant happens. Once that happens, now we can have biological evolution.
Not to interrupt you, but...
You can interrupt.
Okay. Sagan, you know, in one of his books, I have the book, but I don't remember the title. But anyway, writes that he has actually done this experience in the lab, more than about, I think, 60 or 70 times. You know, just random chemicals bringing together, and in some cases, life actually happens.
I don't think anybody's produced life from non-life yet. But,
no, that's what he said. And he said he'd done it multiple times, and he isn't the only one.
So you're saying that Sagan claimed to have created life in a lab?
Yeah, I mean, there was two cells that...
That's not correct.
He was smoking something.
Yeah, that hasn't happened yet. How are, you know, I mean, this is off subject, we're off subject already.
I think Sagan is a pretty down-to-earth person, and he said it was done time and again. And, I mean, he was just trying to show...
Well, if you can find something on that subject and email it to the group, I'd love to read it. But okay, I've never seen that.
I'll see it.
I don't
know if I can find it, but I know I have it in one of the books.
Okay.
Thanks.
All right, let's get back to evolution, which begins after that first cell has somehow...
I'll eat, so I'll shut up.
You're welcome to participate, John. I just find what you're saying hard to believe. I find it hard to believe that's true, and I haven't heard of it yet.
Oh, well, now you just did.
Well, I have higher criteria
for
belief than just hearing about it in the meeting.
What is that?
I want to jump in and say that at the time of Carl Sagan, all they had done is artificially produce complex organic molecules, but none of them were alive.
Right.
None of them.
Right. Well, actually, if you want to just spend a minute talking about the subject, abiogenesis or chemical evolution or biopoiesis or whatever we want to call it, is a process going from these non-living simple chemicals to a living thing. And we now think of that as kind of a chain where the links are being added. And so they can go from, like I said, methane and ammonia to amino acids just by applying a spark. They did that back in the 50s, Miller-Urey experiment. But they've also started to make inroads in other areas. Like there are complex metabolic pathways they're making bilipid membranes. They're making ribonucleic acids and et cetera. So, like I said, it's starting to come together, and it's an interesting subject. Maybe it's one we can talk about next time or another time. The next thing that happened after cells first formed were eukaryote cells. These are much larger, more complicated cells. You may know some of this biology or not, but they're cells with membrane-bound inclusions, like nuclei and ribosomes and Golgi apparati. Okay, then about 600 million years ago, multicellular life first appeared. First, these were colonies. I don't know if we can call these multicellular life. You just have a bunch of single cells living on a stromatolite, for example. But eventually, colonies that functioned as a unit, like sponges, and then that's the periphera, and then later the jellyfish. And of course, these were radially symmetric forms. You could cut them in any direction, and they you could get two halves. Later, life became bilaterally symmetric, and it had a head and it had a tail. And now you couldn't do that anymore. Those are the jumps. And then we have a whole series of phyla that evolved, starting with the Cambrian explosion about 550 million years ago. We have worm-like creatures, then fish-like creatures. And then the fish-like creatures crawl onto the land, and we have the amphibians and the reptiles. And from the reptiles, we get the mammals and the birds. And from the mammals, we eventually come to the primates. Okay? So that's a real quick tour of all of that. Now, first, I want to give you a few words on nomenclature, because the nomenclature in this area can be a headache.
Is what?
Is a headache.
Yeah.
Well, for one thing, it's constantly changing. In the time that I've been reading on this subject, you know, when I first started looking at it maybe two or three decades ago, the line that broke off from the chimps and came our way were called the hominids. Well, that word has a different meaning now. And then up until recently, those were called hominins. And now they're being called hominans. Hominins include the chimps. Oh. So you're going to see, and all these words sound very much alike. And another thing that makes it difficult is they all have a Latin form and an English form. So we belong to phylum chordata, but we're chordates. They belong to class mammalia, but we're mammals. They belong to order primates, but we're primates. So the combination of every one of these words having a Latin form and an English form, and them all sounding alike, and them all changing, makes this a very difficult subject. When you read, it depends how old the source you're looking at is, as to what something's going to be called.
So what's a hominin?
Today?
Yeah.
That's the sub-tribe that includes the chimps and man. Let me just take a second. I'm going to go over it in more detail, but let me just take a second and talk about what happened with the apes. The apes are a superfamily, Hominoidea, and sometimes called the hominoids. That includes the lesser apes and the great apes. The great apes descended from the lesser apes. When you peel off the family of the lesser apes, the Hylobatidae, you're left with the Hominidae, and that's the great apes. And that includes the orangutans, gorillas, chimps, and man. And when I say chimps, I'm including the bonobos. I don't know if you're familiar with that. Bonobo is a different kind of chimp. The genus is Pan. The guy you call a chimp is Pan Troglodytes, and the other one is a little different looking animal that looks, still looks a lot like a chimp, but he's Pan Paniculus. He's a little different. Okay, so there's two genuses or genera of chimps, but I'm just going to call them chimps. Another area that's difficult is we are apes, but sometimes I want a word for the apes that are not man. Okay, let me just say we're apes, and then leave it at that. Now when I refer to apes, I'm mostly talking about things that aren't humans, even though we are apes, okay? So I could say they're quadrupedal apes. I could say they're brachiating apes. That would distinguish them from us, because we're, did I say bipedal? I meant quadrupedal. They're quadrupedal and brachiating. We're bipedal, and we don't brachiate. That's what the gorillas, chimps, and orangutans all have in common, that we don't, and many other things, too. But so
what do you have in common is what?
The other apes?
Yeah.
They're all quadrupedal. By that I mean they're knuckle walkers. They can't stand up.
What?
They can't stand up, but they always go back down onto their four legs.
Right.
And they're brachiators. They go through the trees like this. We don't do that.
And what do you call that?
Brachiator. This is the brachium in Latin, the arm. And brachiation is traveling using your arms. Okay. So now that we've gotten through that little bit, the first primates appear about 50 and 55 million years ago. But let me just say that every single one of these numbers I'm going to give you, I'll just wait for Fred. Every single one of these ranges of numbers I'm going to give you is disputed. When I say the first primates appeared 50 to 55 million years ago, you can go find a book that says 60. Okay, so they're all roughly approximate. It appeared about 50 to 55 million years ago, which is 10 to 15 million years after the asteroidal impact that led to the extinction of the dinosaurs. Now, there were no apes on Earth, or there were no primates on Earth when that happened, but there were other kind of mammals. It used to be called order insectivores. Now they're not in order anymore, but they're little burrowing insect-eating animals. Some of them eventually made it up to the trees, like the tree shrews, but they weren't primates. And that's what we come from, other kinds of mammals. Another area with nomenclature that becomes extremely difficult, this is really difficult, I find, is the names for the different eons, epochs, eras, periods of geologic time. You know, you talk about the Proterozoic era or the Jurassic period or the Eocene epoch, and it just becomes a lot of work. I'm going to try to keep that to a minimum, but still use some of those words as references. And I say that because I'm looking at one right now. The Eocene epoch of the Cenozoic era. The Cenozoic era is the most recent era. That's the one we're in now. And it's broken down into several periods. And the Eocene is the second. The Paleocene was the first. It began about 56 million years ago.
Sorry.
Had enough?
A little more scientific than...
Okay. All right, ladies. Goodbye.
Thank you very much. We wish
you're welcome.
The best.
Yeah. The reason is...
There's one way to separate the wheat from the chaff.
I don't blame them. I mean, this isn't for everybody.
Jeanette is very religious.
Is she?
Yes.
Oh, well.
It's a shame she left.
Yeah.
Jeanette,
the lady.
Okay.
She's very religious.
Well, I would have liked to talk about that if she was willing to, but...
She would have actually been quite willing to talk if we'd gone into that kind of thing.
Yeah,
she likes to express her.
I'd have been willing to forsake this for a month, and here we are. And we don't get a lot of religious people in this room.
That's right. I was looking forward to it.
Well, do you think she was offended by talk of evolution?
I doubt it.
Okay.
But she might have got irritated.
Irritated?
By what? No,
the topic? Okay.
We're talking about her rather than... Yeah.
Yeah, well, in my experience, people that get agitated about evolution are just simply creationists that find that idea to be challenging, they consider blasphemous. So once you're over that line, you're into another world. Well, you know, we're going to talk about this if we get to this second section, but most Christians will tell you that they believe in evolution.
I suppose.
Yeah. The creationists are a minority. But those say, I believe God. God says he made us in 6 days or whatever. And this theory is anathema to them. So it's an interesting subject, but not the one we're talking about today. Okay. Now, the first primates that existed on the earth are the ones called the prosimians. They're still a little bit like furry creatures that you're used to on the ground. They're like us in the sense that they have forward-facing eyes, and they have hands with articulate fingers and opposable thumbs and the kind of collarbone that we would have. And they're like us in a lot of ways, but they still have snouts like a fox and pointy ears like a dog. But they run on the treetops. And they were considered the earliest primates, the prosimians. They also originally had wet noses. The first prosimians that developed dry noses are our ancestors. Those are the tarsiers. Or tarsier-like animals, tarsieriforms, they call them. Keep in mind that all the modern animals are not our ancestors. They're also descendants of our ancestors. But they're very much like our ancestors. Remember when we talked about evolution, there's this misconception that if you get two populations the same amount of time, they're both going to change the same amount. No. The one that stays in the environment that it was adapted to will change very little. The one that finds a new niche, that's the one that's going to change quickly. So what you'll find is millions of years later, one descendant looks an awful lot like its ancestor, and the other population has descendants that look very different. So the prosimians of today are probably very much like the prosimians of the past. Now we're talking about lemurs from Madagascar. We're talking about the lorises in Asia. We're talking about the galagos or bush babies in the Americas and those kind of creatures. I don't know if you've ever seen any of those. We were fortunate enough to get out to Madagascar and saw the lemurs. They're cute little creatures. Incidentally, the prosimians are all nocturnal. Except for the lemurs. They live in the day. The reason for this has to do with the fact that later came monkeys. And monkeys would kill any prosimians. I don't know if they'd kill them and eat them, but they would kill them. And so where monkeys and prosimians live together, one's going to be nocturnal, one's going to be diurnal. And so all of these other creatures are pretty much diurnal. And all the later primates, the monkeys, apes, and men, are going to be daytime dwellers. So eventually the dry-nosed prosimian, like the modern tarsier, split off from the wet-nosed prosimians, and that formed the suborder called Haplorhini, which are the dry-nosed primates. Not just the dry-nosed prosimians, but all of their descendants, which includes the monkeys and apes. Alright, let's get down to the monkeys. These are also called simians. Again, like I said, the language here is difficult. What is a simian? Well, a simian usually means a monkey or an ape, but not a prosimian. Okay. From the prosimians came the monkeys, the first simians, also called anthropoids, comprising infraorder simiforms. They look like simians. They first appeared about 45 million years ago. Compared to the prosimians, the monkeys have flatter faces, shorter, less fox-like snouts, fewer teeth, drier noses, larger brains, and even more forward-looking eyes, and smaller and less mobile outer ears. Once again, think of the ears of a fox and compare them to the ears of a chimp. A chimp's ears are more like ours. Monkeys are broadly classified as Old World and New World. Apparently monkeys first came to the Earth when the Americas and things lying east were all still attached. And that was the supercontinent called Pangaea, which eventually divided.
When did that divide happen?
Over millions of years. You know, I guess I should say I'm glad you brought that up, but I really tried to study that a lot to try to figure out how there could be monkeys on both sides.
Yeah.
If this thing divided back then, before the time they say the monkeys first formed, I really couldn't find an answer to that question. But there's monkeys both in the Americas and in Europe, Asia, and Africa. So monkeys were on the planet when those things were all connected and separated. But the more primitive ones are the ones in the North Americas. The Americas, North and South America. They're called the New World monkeys, and they're ancestral to what became the Old World monkeys, from which the apes came. When we think about New World monkeys, we're talking about the marmosets, the capuchins, you may be familiar with some of these, the spider monkeys, squirrel monkeys, and howler monkeys. But the best examples I can give you of, if you're familiar with Frida Kahlo and her art, do you know the picture of her surrounded by four spider monkeys? Mm-hmm. Okay, and also if you've ever seen an organ grinder with a monkey, that's a capuchin. Those are New World monkeys. They're a little bit different than our old world monkeys.
Yeah.
Old world monkeys can look like things like mandrills and baboons. They're bigger. They have calloused bottoms. They're just a different kind of an animal, and that's what the apes descended from.
Where's the baboon?
I'm sorry?
Where's the baboon in all this?
The baboon's a monkey, believe it or not. He looks like an ape, doesn't he? And that's kind of the point that when you're talking about the old world simians or primates, they do sort of start to become ape-like, even while they're still monkeys. They found transition fossils. There's one called Proconsul that's somewhere between a monkey and an ape. So there was a time when a creature lived that was somewhere in between, but we have no such thing now. All right. And I'll just give you a few features of the... compared to the monkeys, apes are larger, have a broader rib cage, are more muscular, have bigger brains with more convoluted cortices, have color vision, they lack the cheek pouches, they have a fused frontal bone up here in the forehead, more narrow noses with downward pointing nostrils. There's some dental details that might be of interest to some people, but you know they go from having... from having two bicuspids and three molars, or three from premolars and two molars to the other way around, when you go from one set of animals to the other, they go from having four cusps on their teeth to five, and stuff that I just consider not interesting, but these are some of the details that... the other difference is that they have a different shoulder anatomy adapted for swinging through the branches. The monkeys, like the prosimians, walk on the branch tops. They walk along the tops of the branches. The apes don't do that. They swing from them. They dangle from them. The apes' shoulders and wrists are more flexible than the monkeys. They have longer and stronger upper limbs and elbows that can straighten. Monkeys can't straighten their arms. But relatively shorter lower limbs. They have no tail. That's a huge difference between monkeys and apes. Apes don't have a tail, but monkeys have that prehensile tail that lets them hold onto a branch. Okay. And like I said, when we're talking about the great apes, subfamily Hominidae, we're talking about four groups of extant apes. We're talking about the Pongids, they're the orangutans. We're talking about the gorilla group. We're talking about Pan, which is the chimps and bonobos and man. Okay, now let me tell you about something very interesting that happened a long, long time ago. And this is key in the history of the evolution of man, or so it's thought. We talked about how the asteroidal impact changed the face of the Earth and made room for all kinds of new animals to fill new niches. Well, North and South America came together and closed off the space between the Pacific, and the Atlantic Ocean. The Isthmus of Panama formed. And when that happened, the ocean currents changed. They had been going west to east from what would be like the Southern California area through over to the Gulf of Mexico, around Florida. But that all changed when this closed off. Now we have new currents that move in different directions. The Gulf Stream, for example, goes up the east coast of the United States and Canada, and then goes across the Atlantic Ocean. When these things changed, it created changes in climate, and it created changes on the surface of the Earth. And the most important change that's relevant to us is that the rainforests or jungles of northern Africa started to thin out and become the savannas. And when that happened, these tree-dwelling creatures had to come down. And when they came down to Earth, they had to find a new way to make a living. Okay, so that's a kind of an interesting story, I think.
Yeah, I think so, too.
Yeah. And these changes in environment accelerated evolution, which is why the modern apes still look a lot like the ancestral apes. And then dig up these ancient apes, Dryopithecine, doesn't look that different from a gorilla. But we look very different because we've been through something. Yeah. We had a different history. What's that?
Some of us have. Sorry.
So over uncounted generations, ape men came down from the trees, stood up, grew taller, became more gracile. Gracile means less robust. These apes have big chests and were thinner. Grew bigger brains, developed more articulate hands, and lost most of their body hair. They learned to hunt, they learned to eat meat. The apes in the trees were not meat eaters. and eventually learned to tame fire, make tools, acquire language, and migrated across the continents to form complex societies and eventually complex cultures and capable of things like sailing and agriculture. But just how this transition occurred is still being worked out. Which of these changes came first? Gene and I were talking about this earlier, so you don't get an answer. But of all these changes, like here are many of the main differences between us and our ancestors. We're not hairy like they were. We're much taller than they are. We have bigger brains than they do. We have more articulate hands than they do. We walk on 2 feet. We have a different diet. Which of these changes came first and drove the others? Anybody want to take a guess?
I'll guess language.
Language? No.
I would think diet.
Okay. Well, let me tell you how this
works.
Fire. Okay, nobody's got it right. It's going to be bipedalism, standing upright. Lucy, if you may remember that creature, it was found by Don Johansson in 1974 in Africa, is basically a chimp that walks on 2 feet. Mm-hmm. And that answered the question. How do we know that she was bipedal? Here's the answer. I'm going to send you notes. Anybody that's interested, I need your email. But this, I don't know if you can see this, but this is what a human skull looks like underneath. See this big hole here? That's called the foramen magnum, and that's the passageway for nervous tissue to go in and out of the brain and down into the body. The spinal cord comes out of the brain through the foramen magnum. Now, in man, it's on the underside. In this gorilla, it's further back. It's back here. Okay, that means his head was in front of his body. Ours head is over our body. That's how you could tell. So you've probably heard about the fraud called Piltdown Man. It was a hoax.
It's a hoax?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Some people wanted to... this is back when the Germans had already discovered Neanderthals on their property, and the British were having a patriotic moment. And they wanted some creatures of their own. So... So somebody just made them. They took the teeth and skull fragments of many evil humans, orangutans, and chimps, and they dusted them up, and they treated them, and they put them somewhere they would be found. But what they constructed, of course, there was no living thing that looked like that, what they constructed was what they imagined an early ape man looked like. And what they built was something with a big cranial capacity, but a posterior foramen magnum. So they were hypothesizing that the big brain came first, and upright came later. So they were imagining a creature with a big head, skull, and a hole more in the back of the brain than underneath it. And of course, that was all undone later. Incidentally, when we're going to be talking, if we get to it, talking about all these arguments against evolution, one of them is that you just can't trust science and scientists. And this issue is brought up. What about Piltdown Man? Well, of course, that's not science to me, Matt. That was a handful of pranksters who may have been scientists, and it was science that unraveled it and showed us what was true. Science is constantly trying to re-examine itself and decide if it's right or not. Compare that with a Christian hoax, the Shroud of Turin. The church goes to great lengths to defend that. It in no way wants that to be shown to be medieval.
Say that again.
Oh, what, have you heard of the Shroud of Turin?
No.
Okay, it's a cloth. Okay. Piece of cloth.
Oh, I do know.
It's said to be something that Jesus ascended through and left his impression on.
Yes.
But it's been shown to be of medieval origin.
Right.
So it's definitely not what it purports to be. Mm-hmm. But you don't have the church working day and night trying to find the truth. That's the difference. Scientists, as soon as a fraud was perpetrated, began trying to settle it, decide it, prove that it was right or prove that it was wrong. It's very different. So far from calling science untrustworthy, it's exactly the opposite. Well, that's something you can trust. It makes mistakes, but it finds them. It's always looking for them. Okay. So I mentioned Piltdown Man. Okay, I'll read some of the things we've already talked about a little bit. I've covered some of this, but I'm going to read a little bit of it too. In a quadruped, the foramen magnum is located in the occipital part of the brain, that's the back part, over the posterior aspect of the skull. In an animal that stands upright, it is on the inferior aspect of the skull. And that's why Piltdown Man was created with a large cranial capacity, closer to the 1300 to 1400 cc capacity of modern man, compared to about one third of that, 350, 450 in a chimp or lesser ape. Lucy is closer to a chimp in stature. That's Australopithecus afarensis. That's the name of Lucy's species. But it is very much like a chimp, except stands upright. So that's where that that answer came from. She also had reduced canine teeth. Canine teeth, the two in the center are the interior incisors. The two on either side of that are the lateral incisors. And the first two on either side of that are the canines. And in a lot of animals, something like a mandrill or a baboon, they're...
Yeah, fangs.
They're fangs. Yeah, by the time you get to man, that's gone. So the smaller incisors is part of the evolution.
Except Cher.
Does Cher have fangs? Well, she had them drilled or carved.
No, they're natural.
Some of the people that are into, I forget what they call this, the people that want to look like vampires. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Those people have their teeth shaved into fangs. Okay. Now we're going to talk a little bit about hominin skull evolution, or hominan skull evolution. And I've got, unfortunately, I only have, you know, the one picture to pass around, but I'll do that. This is a gorilla skull. This is a human skull. And in between, this is Homo erectus.
He's
one,
what?
Homo erectus, one of our ancestors. And you can see a transition in these skulls that I'm going to be talking about. And I'll just go ahead and pass this around. We talked about the foramen magnum already. And a few mentions about the change in dentition. It wasn't just the number of premolars and molars, just the shape of the canine. There was changes in the enamel and the like, and that was associated with going from one kind of diet to another. When you lived in the trees and you had to chomp on hard things like nuts and twigs, you needed a different kind of dentition. Another thing is that these apes had huge head musculature for that chewing. And most of the changes we see in these apes have to do with that musculature that was there and is now gone. So, for example, many ape skulls have what's called a sagittal crest. It looks like a big mohawk of bone. It's for these large muscles to attach. Then there's an area in the skull here called the zygomatic arch, right here in the cheek, where muscles come down through the temporal fossa, that's this, through that hole and attach to the jaw. Now in apes, this temporal fossa is deep. It's a pan that holds a large muscle, and that hole in the cheekbones is very large to allow these large things to pass through too. Also, these huge muscles attach under the back of the skull, what's called the nuchal ridge, and all those things are present in these apes that have these huge muscles. But as we go from that kind of creature to what we are today, that all changes. A few other changes occurred in the skull. The forehead became taller, the bony ridges here disappeared, and the muzzle disappeared. We used to have a muzzle. I'm just going to go ahead and share this with you right now. But I was going to save it for when we got more into the rest of the body. But this is, and I'll pass it around, but this frame has been fractured, and it has two big holes in it right now, so be careful with it when you do. But this is from a time when my wife and I were in Indonesia at a zoo. And they had this orangutan just out walking free. Now, the story here, what you can't see is my arm hanging off the edge of the picture. It has a popsicle in it.
And what?
A popsicle. I was eating the popsicle. I'll send this around too. But I'm going to want you to look at it again later. What we're going to talk about is the differences between that guy and me.
You're on the right or the left.
I wanted to share my popsicle with this orangutan, but I knew I should ask the zookeeper for permission. And of course, he spoke some Indonesian dialect, and we couldn't speak to each other. So I'm doing it with a gesture, trying to show that I want to give my popsicle to the orangutan. But unwittingly, I'm teasing the animal. And he just decided to take it from me. And he put his arm around me like this, and I felt death.
The animal did?
Yeah. That thing, it was unbelievably strong. He wasn't trying to hurt me. He was just trying to take my popsicle away. Yeah. But I'd never been touched like that by anything before or since. So,
What did your wife think about that?
I don't think she knew how scared I was. But, you know, that thing could have just crushed me right there.
She probably could tell when she did the laundry how scared you were.
Yeah, you're right. Now, what I want you to see, let's compare the difference between what his body looks like and what yours and mine looks like. And here's another illustration I can send around the room, which sort of mimics that. Okay, what are the obvious differences?
Yeah.
What are the obvious differences? Okay, he's much hairier. I'm taller. He's got that low brow. He's got the brow ridge. He's got a muzzle. I don't have any of those. I have a pointy nose. I have a chin. He doesn't have a chin. And if you look at the relative length of his arms and his legs to his body, his arms are much longer compared to his body than mine are, but his legs are shorter. He's also much more robust. He's got this big barrel chest. Like I said, I'm more up and down, especially if I keep an eye on my weight. But he's more wide. And those are a lot of the most of the changes that occurred. Just a couple other things I want to talk about in evolution. I want to talk about the importance of going hairless. I'd never heard of something called persistence hunting. Persistence hunting. Until I started.
He's got the same hair color as our president.
As our
president.
Yes. And that's why he's called an orangutan.
You mean his name was Trump?
I don't know what his name was. But this is one of the interesting changes that occurred in man, too, is we can't race these animals, but they can't sweat. Their bodies are covered with hair. They don't sweat. They release heat by panting, and they can't do that while they're galloping. I don't know if the word gallop applies to animals other than horses, but like when a cheetah is running full speed, can we call that a gallop? Mm. I don't know. But when they are running, when they're sprinting, they can't release heat, so they eventually have to stop. They're much faster than we are, but they can't go as far. What our ancestors learned to do was this so-called persistence hunting, and that's what the loss of the body hair was all about in the development of sweat glands. They could walk or jog, maybe even take a rest. They'd eventually tire these animals down and kill them.
Yeah.
That didn't seem possible to me. I can't imagine how you could ever catch up with one of these animals if you're a human being, but tribes of human beings would do that. They would just wear these things down and kill them. And that's the importance of the hairlessness in man. Okay, I think I have a whole lot here on the various...
How speculative is that theory?
I don't know how you can prove such a thing, yeah. But you can demonstrate what we can do and what they can do.
Yeah.
And so I think that's pretty convincing evidence that those traits evolved so that our ancestors could hunt. This
people
is when they became
meat
eaters.
People are doing it today, for sure.
I've never heard anyone refute that, though.
I don't really see how you can. I mean, how else can they account for these differences?
Right.
What else? They're there for a reason.
You've never heard anyone refute what?
The fact that the early men were persistence hunters. They just ran down deer.
Yeah, that's the way he was survived. That's what I understood.
Yeah.
So when you get these notes, and if you ladies want to be included in this, I need to have email addresses, because I'll just forward all this and you can have it if you like it. There's a lot of information here on our ancestral forms, the hominans, the ones that broke off from the chimp line. And I don't think you want to hear all of this right now, but we have creatures like Homo habilis, the first tool-using man. Homo ergaster, he's a little bit different. Homo ergaster, who appears about 1.5 to 1.8 million years ago, was taller, more slender, probably the first mostly hairless hominin. That's what you'll be reading, things like that. Probably a complex social behavior, since babies that would eventually have bigger brains were being born to females with relatively smaller and more narrow pelvises. So when you see, you know, as the brains get bigger and bigger, the infants have to be born in an earlier and earlier stage. And that means more caretaking. And so the thought is that these mothers were no longer enough, but there was probably a community of caregivers where mothers were helping other mothers and et cetera. Homo ergaster is thought to be the first possibly to leave Africa, but they also say that about erectus, Homo erectus, who came later. So we don't really know who was the first to leave.
The assumption is that the first humans were in Africa.
Yes.
But we don't all believe that.
Almost all.
That's pretty firmly unsettled. However, some of the first... You don't think so? I don't think that's a controversial subject anymore. And one of the pieces of evidence for it is that Neanderthal developed in Europe. Okay, probably came out of Africa and developed in Europe. The peoples of the world that are not from Africa have Neanderthal genes in them. The ones from Africa don't. So that's a pretty good indication that the Neanderthals came out of Africa and that other people who came out of Africa after them interbred with the Neanderthals, but those that are still in Africa never did and don't. And that's one of the pieces of evidence. But there's others. Also, you know, just the age of these ancestral fossils, the oldest ones that we find, Ardipithecus, Australopithecus, they're all in Africa. You don't find creatures in say, Asia like, until you get to something like Java Man, and that's Homo erectus. So Java Man was pretty advanced because he was able to make it to an island. He was sailing.
I think that we're beginning to see, within the past 20 years, remarkable advances in finding fossils and earlier beings, and things are changing.
Rapidly.
Rapidly. So it's hard for me to understand that, even though I'm certainly I believe in evolution, is that that humans all came about from one particular place.
Why is that hard to understand?
Well, because we're all so different. And I see major differences in different parts of the world.
What do you call major differences? Like skin color and eye shape?
Color, body shapes, facial differences. Eyes are dramatically different in different parts of the world, and they're also similar in widely separated areas.
But there are scholars who look precisely at that. Take for example Nina Jablonski, who's an anthropologist in Pennsylvania, and she's taken on the issue of skin color.
Right.
And she shows pretty convincingly that when people moved out of Africa, there were good reasons for them to lose the kind of pigmentation they had back there. Partially because the kind of pigmentation you have makes it harder for you to get enough vitamin C. Vitamin D, sorry. And that it was a gradual thing over a long period of time, but it was essentially a movement geographically that was responsible for things like skin color. And I suspect that's true in many things. Like the Chinese, some Chinese anthropologists and archaeologists have tried to demonstrate that the people of China had an independent origin, and they failed. Essentially, it became clear over studying it that no, they all came from the same place as we did in Africa.
But it's statistically impossible that humans evolved side by side, you know, that these lesser apes turned into humans and these lesser apes turned into humans. That didn't happen. Lesser apes turned into humans and the humans spread. It just doesn't work.
Yeah, I would say that the human involvement didn't stop at this point. When we came around, human involvement did not stop.
It's still happening.
It is still going on.
I want to make a comment about the characteristics you pointed out, that in terms of evolutionary time, those things happen very quickly. You're talking, you know, hundreds of thousands of years, not millions of years.
Right.
So it could have happened, those things happened fast, whereas the time it took to get from Australopithecus to Homo sapiens, that took a long time. But the time it took to go from black to white, from green eyes to brown eyes, things like that, that's an instant.
That can be just one gene.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Also, if there were separate origins, they wouldn't be able to interbreed in all likelihood.
Not at all, no chance of it. The fact that we're one species, that we can have children with Chinese, we can have children with anybody in the world.
Now, the one thing that you've been focusing on for good reasons has been the differences over time. Well, but it's also interesting to look at what's in common. What I think of is a friend of mine was visiting a zoo somewhere in the States, and there was a gorilla there. And the gorilla looked at him, and he was basically saying, why are you out there, and I'm in here. Aren't we the same? What, how cruel this is that you are doing this to me. Isn't there a commonality? And
well, I'm not sure that all that was going through the gorilla's head, but...
you're not sure. And I wasn't there, but my friend is convinced.
That's called anthropomorphism.
Yeah. Or projection.
Projection. Yeah. My wife and I were in Africa, and we were staying in one of these camps, and the room that we had was complete glass. And when we got up in the morning, opened up the curtains all around in this thing, of course, there were all kinds of animals just milling around and everything. And the immediate thing that came to my mind is, I'm in the zoo. You know, I'm the one that's in the zoo, and these people are
in an aquarium. You're in an aquarium.
Yeah, it was a thing. But one of the things that keeps occurring to me are stories, oral history, and I spent a lot of time with American Indians, and their oral stories are really fascinating. Where they come from. If you ask an Indian where he comes from, an American Indian, he would tell you he came from the earth.
He came from where?
The earth.
Oh, the earth.
He just came up out of.
Yeah.
And they will talk. How old are you? I'm 10,000 years old, or I'm 100,000 years old. You know, the stories are absolutely magnificent, and I know they're good stories. But who are we, and where do we come from, and how do we pass along knowledge from one to another when we can't write? We have no means. We don't have paper or
communication
sort of tools. So this story about communication comes into mind immediately. What is the relationship between different peoples around the world and communication? How do we communicate? How did we first start to communicate with each other?
You're talking about before language or after language?
Before language. Well, language is language, whether it's sign language or it's verbal language. Language is language. If you can communicate, it's language.
Okay. Well, I'm talking about what we normally consider language, symbolic words.
That's new.
That's what?
That's new stuff.
But I'm asking if you're talking about before or after that.
But I think the American Indian doesn't support a whole lot of scientists, as far as I know.
It doesn't what?
They don't support an awful lot of scientists. I mean, this... been a development that is definitely...
They don't produce scientists, is that what you're saying?
Well, no.
What is supported?
No, I said...
They
well, I was saying... what was I saying?
take an example. How many people are on the American continent versus the rest of the world?
Well, yeah, well, anyway... We know. A lot of people, you know, think they have some wise guys, if you will... that try to think through, but they can only get so far. You know, I don't know, the Western world, I believe, can take credit for taking, for inventing, if you will, science. And science, and scientists, and it has been developing as well.
So you're saying that the Western world was smarter than the rest of the world?
No, I didn't say that, but I mean, somebody had to be first, and so there are a lot of people from all kinds of areas. I mean, a lot of blacks too that are, or Indians for that matter. I don't know for sure, but I would think could become scientists. But the idea of pursuing science was something that originated in the West, and not all that long ago. You know, maybe a few hundred years only, really, and yeah, really.
How does that relate to the issue of evolution? I'm not sure.
What are we talking about now, John? I'm sorry.
The thing of evolution is, where do people come from?
True.
You know, do they all come from Africa? Which, you know, most of you guys believe
that. But people have these...
And why don't... No, but give us a reason why that is likely not true.
I'll tell you a very simple thing that's going on right now in the world. you guys mostly Americans.
No,
I'm not.
Well,
we're world citizens.
I'm a Mexican. So the right now there's a whole bunch of talk about at the moment. About the Russians and the Americans and the conflicts and all this kind of stuff and everything. The Americans developed what they call a fighter plane. Some call it F-35. It's supposed to be beyond belief. The Russians developed one exactly the same time.
Yeah. What's that got to do with whether we came from Africa?
I'm just saying, things occur in different parts of the world at the same time.
There's different kinds of things. If you're talking about technology.
You're talking about cultural evolution, and we're talking about biological.
That's entirely different issue.
Okay, so it's a bad example.
Well, they're very different things. Ideas can pop up on different sides of the world at the same time, but the genes won't.
Well, that's what we believe now.
Okay. Well, if you want to investigate the subject and present something, that'd be wonderful. But that's not a controversial area in the biological sciences. Man came out of Africa. I guess there's room for doubt, but not much. You can look into that yourself a little bit if you want. It's
I just don't believe that. I'm just one person. I have my own belief system.
Okay. And you have a belief system based on no evidence, is what I'm arguing.
No,
and
I have the evidence in my mind. I understand. You don't agree with the evidence. You don't agree with the evidence.
I'm sorry, sir. You haven't given evidence? Any evidence.
What is the evidence, Gene?
Okay. Here's another example. Where did the American Indians come from?
Probably Asia.
How did
they get here? That's also been proven not to be true.
Well, I don't know, but
we found here in South America evidence of people 30,000 years ago, long before the Bering Straits were a route to come over.
Is that evidence that man did not come out of Africa? That's what Fred's asking for.
Well, it's evidence that things that we grew up with and believed in are changing rapidly.
Absolutely. Oh, that happens all the time.
Nobody's saying that these ideas can't change in the future, but right now they're not controversial because all the evidence points to that idea, and there's not contradictory evidence.
Well, it was controversial right here in this room.
But you haven't given...
We're not scientists.
You haven't given any evidence kind of thing about...
Right.
No, but you haven't stated any.
Are there any fossils of pre-humans in South America?
South America?
Yeah, like a million years old.
I believe there are, but I'm
a million years old.
Oh, I don't know if we're a million years old. Certainly well over 30,000 years old.
Oh, sure. That's a blink of an eye.
I'm
talking about
I don't know.
But there is evidence of fossils of humans in Africa a million years ago.
Okay, well, listen.
So what does that tell you?
Well, I know that in Peru, they made pyramids long before the Egyptians.
We're talking 50,000 years, not a million years. A million years, how many 50,000s are in a million? There's 50,000s in a million.
That's a long time.
That's
a very strong argument.
So why doesn't that convince you? There are million-year-old fossils in Africa of something human-like. There are none in America or South America.
Why am I an atheist?
Why does that not convince you?
Why am I an atheist? You know...
Your point is that I believe, I have no evidence for it, but I believe that humans came were in different places earlier, not just from Africa, at the same time. But there is
approximately the same.
But there is no fossil evidence other than in Africa of human remains, human fossils being anywhere else in the world. So despite that fact, which is a known fact, which can be, you can look up in all the
I don't disagree with that.
So then, what's the explanation for why there aren't any other fossils in South America?
My thought process is that we're finding things so rapidly today we don't know tomorrow.
So we're going to find million-year-old fossils in South America, is what you're saying.
Is it all that important as to where they first came from?
It's not that important, but the point I'm making is you have to have evidence to have a point of view even.
Yeah, right.
And you're saying, I think they came from all over the place, but I have no evidence for it. I just have this feeling.
You say I have no evidence for it. If I look at the world, and look at the different the peoples of the world and see how different they are.
We're talking about a very recent phenomenon.
I'd like to speak.
You say it's a recent phenomenon. You don't know
what you want to say, Jerry.
I'd like to speak. Your two examples that you gave, the F-35, for instance, I say is more likely due to espionage than it is to simultaneously inventing this fabulous airplane. The second point is that Eskimos fish along the edge of the ice in boats.
Right.
And they've been doing that, I'm guessing, forever.
Forever, right.
And there are places in Virginia where human remains and stone tools, Clovis points actually, have been found in 30 to 40,000 year old digs.
Right.
And those people came, there was a Solutrians came from Spain and France during the Ice Age, in their canoes, hunting walrus and seals and who knows what, and just kept going and going and going, and got there. They also came around the Pacific in the Ice Age, too, hunting on the ice, going south.
I believe that.
So that explains, but they all came from Africa.
Originally.
But as a principle, you're saying things are changing so rapidly, we won't know what we find tomorrow. To use that anticipatory evidence to change what we believe, what we know today, is, you know, is irrational.
Yeah, the modern idea has to fit the evidence that we have now.
Yes.
New evidence might change that.
Exactly.
We might have new ideas in the future, but right now, what the evidence says is what we're saying.
Yeah, the lack of evidence isn't the evidence of something.
Right.
Well, what people sometimes say is absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. Although I think the right way to say it is absence of expected evidence. Absence of expected evidence is absence of evidence. Evidence of absence. No, if I could just take a second to talk about it. If you say you drove down the Carretera past Cologne yesterday at 2 o'clock, there's not going to be any evidence of that. The absence of evidence that happened is not evidence that it didn't happen. On the other hand, if you say you were in an accident there and you skidded on the brakes and you left tread marks on the road, and none of that's there. That's expected evidence. That argues against your story. So it's the absence of expected evidence that is evidence of absence. Would you agree?
Sure.
Sure.
Fine point.
Okay, well, that's an interesting point. And it's often misstated. Absence of proof is not proof of absence. Proof and evidence are different things. So, what's that? I don't think we're going to get to this other section. Arguments against evolution, just because it's hours getting a little bit late, and I think we're all probably a little fatigued.
Can you summarize the arguments against?
Yeah, I'm interested in
that. All right, well, let me just spend a moment then, if there's that interest. The first thing I wanted to say was that there are no credible counter-arguments against evolution. They're all religious arguments. This is a theory that unifies multiple types of evidence under an explanatory mechanism that is plausible and accounts for the observation of evolution. We've seen evolution. The theory tries to explain it. It's a falsifiable theory. Yeah, like I said, if they ever find human remains under trilobites, something's terribly wrong. It has had practical applications in areas like agriculture and medicine, so it's been put to use. And it works. Talking about whether it's true or not is kind of pointless. It explains what we see, it predicts what we are likely to see and are never going to see, and it's, like I said, it's been put to work. And there's no competition. The religious argument does none of those things. It explains nothing. Just saying God did it is no more explanatory than saying it did it itself. You know, it's not an explanation, it's just a claim. So there really isn't an argument. But
so there are no scientific arguments.
There's no scientific argument against evolution, right? They're all religious arguments.
Okay.
And they're all fallacious arguments, and in the worst cases, they're deliberate deceptions. I'll tell you about one of the deceptions. This one, this has horrified me when I read this. I don't know if you know about the story about human chromosome 2.
What was that?
Human chromosome 2. Okay, we have 23 pairs of chromosomes. And the other three groups, A, X, have 24. It can be shown that one of our chromosomes is an end-to-end fusion of two of the other eight chromosomes. And the way you show that, if you know something about chromosome morphology, in the center, they have a little piece called the centromere, that allows the two chromatids to bind together during cell division, cell replication and division. And on the ends, they have caps that are called telomeres. Okay, well, when these two chromosomes fuse, what happens, what you would expect, there's now telomeric code in the center of the chromosome. It used to be the two ends. And there's two centromeres on either side of that central telomeric material. Furthermore, when you do banding of this chromosome, you can see which two eighth chromosomes it is. So that's pretty much smoking gun evidence that we had a common ancestral ape that we all descended from. And somewhere along the line where the chimps and we separated, one of our ancestors had this fusion event. And now all of our people have 23 chromosomes, and they still all have 24. But let me see if I can read you this this argument that's absolutely horrifying.
Depends who the listener is.
Huh?
Shall we have the scary music?
I can't find this stuff that says. I thought I'd go through them. Oh, here it is. Man cannot have descended from a common ancestral great ape because all the other apes have 24 pair of chromosomes and man has 23, implying the loss of a whole chromosome, which would be fatal. Now, how can somebody writing this stuff not know this science? And as soon as you give him that science, do you think he's going to change and go, oh, I made a mistake? No, this is just going to keep reappearing in the apologetics over and over. These are the kind of arguments that we contend with. But let me give a few of the others. Many of the arguments are in the form of what we don't know or what we've never seen. But that's not how science is done. Listen to this one. Do you know about the difference between, they'll call it microevolution and macroevolution? You know what I'm talking about when I use those terms? What they're saying is it's undeniable that things evolve. We've seen it happen in the laboratory. They say, okay, you can have that, but we're calling that microevolution. It never goes beyond that. Things don't change into other kinds of things. They just have this tiny little bit. So they go, there's microevolution, yes, but you've never seen macroevolution. Well, of course not. That would be occurring over more than millennia. Yeah, and we've only been watching this for a century and a half or so. But here, microevolution has never been observed. Sure, organisms can adapt to their environments in small ways, so-called microevolution, but have never been seen to transform into other kind of animals, which, of course, is irrelevant. We didn't expect to see that. We don't expect to see new families of animals arising over decades or centuries. Furthermore, science is the explanation of what has been observed, not what has not been observed. Something not being observed, once again, is only relevant if it would be expected that we would observe it, if it should be evident. And we can't account for it. It's not that might be meaningful. But just to say we haven't seen it. You get the same argument with we've never seen life form de novo from non-life. So it doesn't happen. Well, this is a different world. You know, when that happened billions of years ago, those little chemicals that were forming weren't being eaten up as nutrition by other living things all around them. That's just not going to happen in the seas anymore. Because anything that gets that far along is going to get swallowed. So, and there are other differences between this earth and that earth, you know, oxygen tension and the atmosphere and the like. I'll just give you a handful of more of these. Oh, have you heard this one? If man evolved from apes, why are there still apes? Have you heard that one?
Got you there.
I thought what with the Jehovah's Witness again. Michael liked this. I go, well, if Americans evolved from Brits, why are there still Brits? It's exactly the same answer.
Well, of course, I know a Republican senator who is clearly a member of the apes.
Who are you talking about?
Which one are you referring to?
That's what I'm referring to. Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, he's very anti everything. Anti-climate science, anti-evolution.
Yeah, he has no brains.
How about this one? Evolution is only a theory that cannot be proven. You heard that one?
Yeah.
Say that again?
Okay, evolution is only a theory.
Theory.
Okay, well, that's a misunderstanding.
Kind of like gravitation.
It's kind of a misunderstanding of what a scientific theory is. Yeah. First of all, there's another use of the word theory, which essentially means the same as hypothesis.
Yeah, that's right.
Like when you say, I have a theory that so-and-so went to the star, that's not a scientific theory. That's a hypothesis. That's a guess that might be substantiated or might not be.
Yeah.
But a scientific theory is the highest form of scientific knowledge there is. Scientific theories are explanatory mechanisms that unify facts. So saying it's only a theory is just nonsense.
Yeah. Well, we still would say that it is only a theory in the sense.
I wouldn't put the word only in there.
Yeah, but fair enough. But the point is, science never says this is true. Science says this is our best. and we're always prepared to shift things in the light of new knowledge.
Yes.
We will tend to sometimes be a little bit less dogmatic than you have to be in racing through this.
You don't have to call the theory of evolution proven. No theory is ever proven.
They're never proven.
They can be disproven.
But the life, the odds is.
What you have to say is it fits the evidence and it's useful.
Yes.
It makes predictions that have always been confirmed, never been contradicted, and it works. I can use these ideas to make the world work. How much do you want to argue with the Apollo engineers who sent and sent that thing to the moon and back?
But we won't.
It worked.
But we won't, in principle, be upset if something comes along that makes us reevaluate. But that's the way we expect science to go, and we say thank you for that.
Well, now we bring up a philosophical issue. What if something did arise that showed that the theory of evolution could not be correct? What will we do next?
We'd go down we
would go back to the drawing board and start another idea? It again.
Is there another idea that could account for all the rest of the evidence, too?
We don't have one.
No, we don't.
No.
I can only think of one. I can only think of one, and it's so far-fetched and absurd, I'm embarrassed to say it. That an intelligent designer came to Earth and planted fossils and nested hierarchies in order to deceive us, in order to make us think evolution occurred. I don't see how you could come up with any other thought than that, and somehow you had to throw out the theory of evolution. That theory is so well established.
It is enormously well established, except that there have been times when people only had one or two explanations, and then something came along that made both of them look. And we did then start generating additional stuff. But if we're pushed to think through other options, we will. But right now, I can't think of it.
Well, we should always have a list of candidate hypotheses.
Sure.
Everything we think of that's not logically impossible to account for this. You can even put a God on that.
Sure.
Like I said, I can't take that idea off the list. I just put it at the bottom because it's the least parsimonious explanation for reality that there is. I mean, here's another one of these arguments. It's the argument from incredulity. I just can't see it. I just can't see it. Therefore, it didn't happen. I don't see how a cell could form itself out of nothing. So therefore, my hypothesis that's going to solve this problem for how a cell can exist uncreated and undesigned is, I'm going to posit an uncreated and undesigned God. Well, that just makes the problem 100 times more difficult, doesn't it? And answer anything and solve anything. That would be... I lost my train of thought. I forgot why I was talking about that.
It was a good train of thought.
About the was it Lamarck who?
Yeah. Lamarck was the one who said the traits became part of the DNA.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does anyone still at all?
I don't think there's any support for that.
I've heard that we can influence protein folding, and that we don't change the code, but we change the way proteins are folded, and that we can. I don't believe it, but the theory that Lamarckian sort of evolution continues with this. I mean, they're trying very hard to make it fit the.
It does. You know, it doesn't really make sense to me.
Well, wait. It's methylation is what he's talking about. That the genes somehow get a methyl. A hydroxy.
Okay, I know what you're talking about. Epigenetics is what they call this.
Yeah, epigenetics. Yeah. That's what you're talking about, and yes, it has been shown, but it's the strange thing about it is it's not in the neck. If you get methylated here, your mother, it's not the daughter or the son, it's the grandchildren that show the trait. Now, that to me is just really strange, but they've shown it over and over.
I think they used to call that skipping a generation, but I don't really know the science behind that.
Well, I don't think anybody does.
But Lamarckianism, for those that aren't familiar, is the idea that changes in the body are then translated into changes in the genome instead of the other way around. Darwinism says that it begins with a change in the DNA, a random mutation or a reshuffle or something like that, and then that becomes manifest in the phenome, the body. Lamarck was hypothesizing the other direction around. Who can say that it doesn't happen, but we don't have a mechanism for it? How could if I suddenly have a new enzyme, where did it come from? And how's the code for it going to get into my DNA? That seems pretty far-fetched.
Well, the genes may lie dormant in a generation for some reason.
I'm talking about genes that are not in the DNA. I'm talking about
the DNA. Yeah. Okay.
Here's another one. Living things are irreducibly complex. Have you heard this argument?
Sorry. Living things are?
Irreducibly complex. This comes from the ID people. Mm-hmm. This is their idea. This is for the ID people say that for Darwinian evolution to occur, there has to be incremental changes that are capable of occurring with a mutation or two, and that each one would be selected for. And some things just work as a unified whole. And the first example they gave was the eye. They said, how can you evolve an eye? Because if you take the lens out, it doesn't work. If you take the retina out, it doesn't work. If you take the pupil out, it doesn't work. So how could you, all these parts come together? It just couldn't be done by evolution. And that idea is called, they're saying that this thing is irreducibly complex. And if you can't reduce it to something that's also functional that's smaller, then it can't have evolved up the other way. But of course, they've made this claim in about 5 or 6 different systems. They made that claim about the eye. They made that claim about the bacterial flagellum. They made that claim about the coagulation of cascade, and they made that claim about the immune system. And every single one of those has been shown to not be irreducibly complex.
Yeah. The things that at each, I think, that at each step along the way, what developed was something that was indeed able to persist in a certain environment.
There was a slightly better adaptation.
Or one that was able to persist somewhere. Not necessarily there. Like, that's another...
Dawkins did a good rebuttal on the irreducible complexity of the eye. You can see a video on YouTube if you want to. And he shows the evolution of the eye. It begins with just a depression. Well, it actually begins with light-sensitive cells on the surface that then form a cup that later enclose and blah, blah, blah. You can go step by step by step. Another one they say is that we're irreducibly complex. I had this argument recently. You take out the heart, you die. You take out the liver, you die. Well, what's wrong with that argument?
They took out my adenoids. I didn't die.
Well, what's wrong with this argument? Obviously, we're not irreducibly complex. We formed from a single cell, a zygote. We were once one cell, then two cells, then four cells, and every single one of those stages along the way was a living thing that was well adapted to its present environment. So, anyway, these are some of the kind of arguments, and I thought it would be kind of fun to get into the philosophy a little bit and get out of the science, so we didn't have to talk about hominins all day.
I'm not free will in these sessions.
Hmm? Oh, yeah.
What should I say?
I just want to take some notes.
Yeah. No, what about free will and evolution?
Where did you get that information anyway? I want to
know. There is an interesting It's only all off the internet.
Stephen, I'd be interested sometime, not today, but in having a discussion of the next step, perhaps.
Where's the evolving to?
Is this maybe the end of biology with transhumanism and CRISPR and hip replacements and all this? Have we now got rid of biological evolution and we're into something where we would say humans are design space? We can make ourselves whatever we want, and that's a whole new ball game.
But we're already into that.
Yeah.
Don't you think?
We're into it, but the implications, anyway, that's...
But I wanted to read you a couple of very fancy sentences that basically say, I just don't see it.
What?
I'm just going to read you about the arguments from incredulity, which is a typological fallacy, which basically say, in one form or another, something says somebody just can't believe it. Or can't see how it can happen. In this case, evolution. These most commonly are arguments from complexity. It's just too complex to have arisen naturally. But complexity is not an argument for intelligence. Irreducible complexity would be. And something called specified complexity. If you find language, if you find the stars tonight arrange themselves into a pattern that says hello, you can probably attribute intelligence to that.
That'd be a belief.
That'd be the kind of complexity that would introduce intelligence.
It was misspelled.
Well, they're not quite as intelligent.
Dumb God.
But the point is that complexity, if things become slightly more complex on and on and on and on, you can have hugely complex systems that are very naturalistic. It's not an argument for intelligence. But let me give you two examples that I found in my reading of that basically what these people are both saying is, I just don't see it. That's their argument, why it didn't happen. From Thomas Nagel in his 2012 book, Mind and Cosmos, Why the Materialist Neo-Darwin
Darwinian conception of nature is almost certainly false. He elaborates his critiques of Darwinism. It is, and listen to the fancy language that he addresses. I just don't see it. It is prima facie highly implausible that life as we know it is the result of a sequence of physical accidents together with the mechanism of natural selection. We are expected by mainstream biologists to abandon this naive response, critiquing standard materialist explanations of life's origins, not in favor of an alternative that is really a schema for explanation supported by example. What is lacking to my knowledge is a credible argument that the story has a non-negligible probability of being true. Like I said, that really comes down to, I consider it unlikely. That's an argument for incredulity. And I found another one that's just as impossible to speak. The words are just as... Jerry Fodor says, natural selection cannot be the mechanism that generates the historical taxonomy of species. For the theory of natural selection is internally flawed. There's a crack in the foundation. Random mutation and natural selection alone are unable to find the extremely rare DNA sequences that yield solutions to complex biological problems. The challenge for gradualist adaptationism is to explain how mutations capable of producing full wings can have accumulated silently over a long evolutionary time in the absence of any adaptive advantage. Well, first of all, he doesn't really understand how wings evolved. But once again, he's saying it just seems too complex to me. These are common kind arguments. They're not arguments. They are arguments, but they're fallacious ones.
What do the Christians say about AIDS? I mean, this is something that happened in their lifetime that wasn't there when they were born, and now it's here. So where did it come from?
Christians don't say anything.
Oh, it's not real evolution.
It's microevolution. That's what you'll hear. We don't doubt that there are going to be microevolution, but you've never seen micro, but you've never seen macro, and you never will, because God created the kinds. You know that term, the kinds? What the kinds mostly correlate with are what biologists would call families, like finches. Darwin's finches are what they would call a kind. And so they go, well, finches never evolved into owls. Yeah. They don't stop being finches. Well, yeah, in our lifetimes they don't, but if you go back far enough in time, finches and owls have a common reptilian ancestor, and probably a common avian ancestor.
But life didn't start until 6,000 years ago, is what Christians claim also.
Well, we deal with the young earth creationists and the old earth creationists. There's both kinds.
Oh, I didn't realize.
Stephen, I think the basic argument that they have there that would never really be stated would be, this is wrong because I don't like it.
Sure.
And I don't like it because the people who I respect don't like it. Sure. And we're into families where people buy what people they trust are saying.
That's right.
And that's the whole thing about, if you like, kinds or what... We're into groups where, as a group, our respected people don't like that idea, and therefore I don't.
Exactly. But this is faith-based thought contrasted with reason and evidence-based thought. There are completely different ways of thinking. Faith-based thought begins with an idea that just says it's true.
Yeah.
And then begins sifting through the evidence to support that.
And yet, I think it is pretty clearly demonstrated that all of us basically are faith-based. That most of our lives are based on gut reactions. And we then use our rational stuff to justify what we've already taken based on our guts.
Well, to the extent that you do that, I would probably agree that's faith-based thinking. If you have a belief that's not...
But that's being human. And it's really a very minor thing that where people actually go through evidence and determine things based on that, as opposed to going with their gut
instinct. That's probably true with a lot of people. I would disagree that's not how I've lived my life. And I think my ideas are, I've reviewed them. And if I don't have a reason for believing them, I reject them. You know, some of them did get in before I learned to think critically. But then when you notice those ideas, you go, I don't know why I believe this, and I can't support it. Then you change how you feel about that idea. And so when
critical thinking is really a very minor element in human reality.
I think it's what we've been doing in this room all hour.
But
I've got a question, Stephen. Is it so that the main driver of evolution is adaptation?
The main driver is probably mutation.
Mutation and then survival of the fittest, etc.
Terrible mutations and natural selection work together.
That was the background. What then do you think is the utility value of consciousness in all this?
Well, that's an interesting question. What is utility? Well, I think what they say is that consciousness helps us model the outside world inside. But so we can try out ideas.
Because these theories of, was it Libet, etc.?
Yeah, Libet.
Mm-hmm. Showed that everything happens before we're conscious of it.
Right. Well, okay, yeah. And now you're getting back into the free will thing. Yeah. He's talking about the experiment where, is everyone familiar with this one? Where people were asked to do something with either the left hand or the right hand. And they were being monitored with a kind of a brain scan. I don't know what it was, PET scan, EEG, something. And experimenters were able to tell what the individual's choice would be before they made the choice, because they could see the choice being made in the brain in the subconscious levels before it reached consciousness. So if you can see somebody's subconscious before they do, you know what they're going to do. And that says, so where's the free will in this?
Yep.
All you are is just the passive recipient of instruction from down
below. Conscious free will, but that's another argument. Interesting, what value actually does consciousness have in evolutionary terms?
Well, imagine trying to navigate life unconscious.
Well, yeah, I can imagine it.
Well, we do it all the time. Like an awful lot of the time when we're driving from Ahiheek to Chapala, we're on...
Well, that's not what I mean by unconscious.
Automatic pilot.
That's not what I mean.
And we're not aware, we can't... Afterwards, I ask you what happened. You couldn't tell me anything that happened.
Yeah, that's the way this attention is to
unless a little kid runs in front of you.
Okay. Then
you can see your reaction.
So you're conscious, aren't you?
Right.
Well,
but your reaction predates.
You aren't conscious. He's just talking about unfocused consciousness.
Yes.
No, I'm just wondering, what does conscience have a use?
Well, I'm just saying, try to imagine getting through life without it.
I can.
Well, really?
Imagine not being enjoyable.
You wouldn't even notice it. You just lie there and ride in bed.
What about senescence? What about...
What's the value of it? That's a good question, too. These are all good questions. Maybe they should be topics for the future. I think we've got... John and I are trying to work something out, and Phil has. And Lloyd Coonley, who's not here today, also wants to present something. But we have a few more months this year. That we need to find. Thank you. If anybody here has an idea that they want to present, I'd like to hear it. You do, Fred?
I'd be happy to talk about transhumanism and the future of biological evolution as opposed to something else.
Okay. Would you send me an email to that effect? I'll just keep the email.
Sure.
Good. Anybody else have anything they want to do?
You have my...
I have yours. I was writing an answer to you
Yeah, right.
today that I didn't send yet.